I had good news, so I could bring a smile to his face, but I don't. Colin paused at the doorway. What has Nadine been up to while I've been gone?
Well, I've been down here guarding the sliff much of the time, but from what I've seen, she's been giving the staff herbs to try to protect them and to use in smoking the palace. It's a good thing the place is made mostly of stone, or it would have been burned down by now. She's been conferring with Drefin and helping him and talking to the staff and others who come for advice. Lord Rawl asked her to go out to visit herb sellers and such to make sure they are not hucksters out to swindle people who are in fear for their lives. The city seems to be sprouting shameless mountebanks the way the sudden warmth seems to be bringing green grass. Nadine also gives reports to Lord Rawl, but he has been gone much of the time, and as busy as she seems to be trying to help people, the visits since he returned are short.
Colin tapped the side of her fist against the doorway.
Thanks, Kara.
She looked into the other's blue eyes.
There are rats down here. Are you all right?
There are worse things than rats.
Indeed there are,
Colin whispered. Chapter 48. It was late, and with the dark, people on the streets didn't recognize her. Without her usual escort of guards, they had no reason to give her a second look, no reason to suspect she was the Mother Confessor out among them. Just as well. There were some people who wished the Mother Confessor harm. Mostly, people kept their distance from her, as they did with everyone else, hoping to keep the plague from themselves. As Kara had said, there were hucksters everywhere, hawking potions to ward off the plague, or to cure your loved ones already stricken. Others strolled the streets with trays held up on straps over their shoulders, neatly laid out with amulets possessing magic to protect against the plague. Colin remembered seeing some of these same people not long ago selling the same amulets as magic to find a husband or wife, or to enthrall an unfaithful spouse. Old women with small carts or simple wooden stands sold carved, spell-invested plaques made to hang over the door to a home as a sure way to keep the plague from entering the house. As late as it was, business seemed brisk. Even the vendors selling meats and produce extolled the healthful virtues of their goods and their value in promoting continued health, if eaten regularly, of course. Colin would send the soldiers out to put a stop to some of these swindlers, but she knew that such intervention would likely be viewed with hostility on the part of the buyers. If she tried to use the army to stop such foolish practices, desperate people would concoct theories about those in power wanting to stop the cures so that the decent, working folk would get the plague. Despite common sense or evidence to the contrary, many people believed that those in power were always scheming to harm them. If they only knew the truth. If Colin were to order the sale of these items stopped, the cures would be sold in secret and for a higher price. No matter how insupportable the claims of these cures, their benefits would be vehemently supported as self-evident truth. Wizard's first rule. People would believe any lie, either because they wanted to believe it was true or because they feared it was. These people were desperate, and would become more so yet. Many wanted to believe. Colin tried to imagine what she would do if Richard had the plague. Would she be despairing enough to put her faith in such trickery, hoping against hope that it would save him? Sometimes hope was all people had. Groundless as it was, she couldn't take that hope away from them. It was all they had, and all they could do. It was up to Colin and Richard to do that which would help these people. As she made her way through the familiar splendor of the Confessor's Palace, on her way to find Richard, Colin paused at the open double doors to a large room used for formal receptions. The room was a calming blue color, with dark blue drapes over the tall, narrow windows. The granite floor had a starburst pattern of darker and lighter stone radiating out from the center. Lamps on cherrywood stands around the edge of the room lent a mellow light to the gathering hall. The table, where small foods were sometimes set out for guests, now held only an array of candles. Colin's attention had been drawn by the sound of Drefin's voice. He stood to the right, before the table with the candles, speaking to perhaps 50 or 60 people. They sat cross-legged on the floor before him, listening with rapt attention as he spoke of the way of health, of keeping the body sound by being in touch with the inner self. Most of the people nodded absently as they listened to Drefin explaining how, by defiling their bodies with unhealthy thoughts and actions, people opened the pathway for sickness to enter. He told them that the Creator had endowed them with the ability to fight off things such as the plague, if only they would do as nature provided, by eating the right foods that would strengthen the auras that defended the body, and by using inner reflection to direct the vigor of various energy fields to their proper function in harmony with the whole. Many of the things he said made sense. Not eating foods that you knew gave you headaches, because it interfered with the mind's ability to regulate the body. Not eating foods that you knew caused pains and cramps in the gut, because it interfered with the body's ability to digest the good foods you needed. Not eating heavy meals right before sleeping, because it interfered with your body getting the rest it needed to remain strong, and how all of these things disrupt the auras that give us strength and protect health. People marveled openly that Drefin could make it all so simple for them to understand. They spoke as if they had been blind, and now, for the first time, had vision. They watched with unblinking eyes as he went on, telling them that we had within us the power to control our own bodies, and that disease could only afflict us if we allowed it to. He spoke of herbs and foods that purged poisons from the body and left people truly healthy for perhaps the first time since their birth. These people weren't listening to Lord Rawl's brother. They were listening to Drefin Rawl, High Priest of the Roch Moss. As one, they followed the High Priest's instructions when he told them to close their eyes and draw the breath of life and healthy steams through their noses and down into their inner core by using the muscles low in their bellies. He explained how to let it reach deep into the source of the power of each person's unique aura, to draw out the poisons from the furthest, darkest corners of their beings and expel it out through the mouth, to be replaced with a renewing breath of life drawn in again through the nose. Better, Colin guessed, that these people would come to Drefin for advice that might help them, and at least sounded like it could do no harm, than spend their savings on false hope from the hucksters in the street. Paying attention to their body's needs with things like proper food and rest seemed sound advice. As they all drew the slow, deep breaths in through their noses, Drefin turned his head and locked his darkened raw eyes on Colin, as if he had known all along that she had been standing there outside the doorway. He gave her a kind-hearted smile that sparkled benevolently in his blue eyes. She could see why these people put their trust in him. She made herself return a little smile. Colin remembered the talk she had had with Shota about how difficult it was to banish unpleasant memories. Colin wished she could forget Drefin's hand between Kara's legs. Drefin was trying to help people. He was doing everything he could to halt the plague. He was a great healer, the High Priest of the Roch Moss. She tried to put the image of him comforting those sick children in place of the memory of his forcing his big hand down between Kara's legs. Drefin had explained at the time why he had done that to Kara. He had saved Kara's life. A moored Sith, screaming in pain, then unconscious, and Drefin had brought her back. Richard found comfort in Drefin, as did everyone else. Colin broke eye contact with him and continued on her way to find Richard. Tristan Bashkar, the Jarian ambassador staying at the Confessor's Palace while he waited for further signs from the stars, further word from above, before surrendering, paused at a balcony as she passed below. As was his habit, he drew back his coat and rested his hand on his hip. It displayed the wicked dagger he wore at his belt. Oftentimes, in conversation, he would also put a boot up on a chair or stool and casually rest his forearm on his knee. It provided those in conversation with him the opportunity to see also the knife he kept in his boot. The more she saw Tristan in the palace, watching her with his cunning eyes, the more she disliked his presence. If there was a man who acted more childish, Colin didn't know him. Tristan watched silently as she hurried on her way. Colin was glad he was up on a balcony, so that she wouldn't have to waste time playing word games with him. Ulick and Egan gave Colin an odd look as she greeted them before whisking through the door to the small room Richard liked to use to study Kolo's journal. He was sitting with his head in his hands, his fingers buried in his hair, as he read from another book that lay open on the table. Two candles and a lamp on the table beside him provided light, and a small, fragrant fire of birch logs added warmth to the cozy room. His cloak lay over a nearby chair, but he wore his sword. Richard looked up. When he saw her, he shot to his feet. Without the gold cloak, he was like a big, black shadow gliding across the room. Before he could speak, Colin rushed into his arms. Colin pressed the side of her face to his chest as she hugged him.
"Please, Richard, don't yell at me, please. Just hold me."
Tears choked her voice.
"Please, don't say anything. Just hold me."
It was ecstasy being with him again. It never failed to astound her, whenever she saw him, just how much she needed and loved him. Richard's arms enclosed her in comforting shelter. She listened to the fire crackle and the sound of his heart under her ear. She could almost imagine, in the safety of his strong arms, that everything was fine and that they had a future. She remembered her mother's words.
"Confessors don't have love, Colin. They have duty."
Colin clutched his black shirt as she fought a losing battle to hold back tears. He held her and stroked her hair. She had asked him to hold her and not speak, and he was doing just that. That only made her feel worse. He must have questions. He must want to say something to her, to tell her how relieved he was to see her safe, to tell her how worried he had been, to ask her where she had been and what she had found out, to tell her what he had found, to yell at her. But he didn't. Instead, without protest, he did as she had asked, relegating his own desires to secondary, after hers. How would she go on without his love? How would she draw a breath? How would she manage to make herself go on until she was old and could finally finish her duty and at last die?
"Richard, I'm so sorry I made that letter sound threatening. I didn't mean to threaten you, I swear. I just wanted you to be safe. I'm so sorry if I hurt you."
He squeezed her a little tighter and kissed the top of her head. Colin wished she could just die in his arms now and not have to face her duty, not have to face the finality of the future, the finality of losing him.
"How's your foot?" she asked.
"My foot?"
"Kara said you hurt it on a chair."
"Oh, my foot is fine. The chair died, but I don't think it suffered." Against all odds, Colin laughed. She looked up through her tears into his gentle smile.
"All right. I think your hug has revived me. You can yell at me now."
He kissed her instead. The feeling of being pulled up in his arms was rapture. Being in the slip didn't even come close. "So," he finally said, "what did our ancestors' spirits have to say?"
Our ancestors... How did you know that I went to the mud people?"
Richard's brow curved into a bewildered cast. "Colin, your face is all painted so the ancestor spirits could see you in a gathering. Did you think I wouldn't notice?"
Colin touched her fingers to her forehead, to her cheek. "I was in such a hurry I never even gave it any thought. No wonder people have been giving me such odd looks."
As she had raced through the palace looking for him, three different women on the staff had offered to draw her a bath. Everyone must have thought she had gone mad. Richard's expression turned serious as he settled his arms around her waist. "So what did the ancestor spirits have to say?" Colin steeled herself. She tilted her head, indicating the bone knife on her arm.
"Grandfather's spirit called me through his bone knife. He had to speak with me. He told me that the plague isn't confined to Adendrill. It's spread all over the Midlands."
Richard tensed. "Do you think it's true?"
"Elder Bregenderen had the tokens on his legs. He's probably dead by now. Some children reported that they saw a woman near the mud people's village. She showed them something with colored light, just like what Lily told us she saw. One of those children has already died. Sister Amelia was there."
"Dear spirits," Richard whispered.
"It gets worse. The spirit showed me other places I know in the Midlands. He said that the plague has spread to all these places, too. The spirit showed me what will be if the plague isn't stopped. Death will sweep the land. Few will survive. The spirit told me that magic stolen from the Temple of the Wind started the plague, but that the plague itself isn't magic. Jagang has used magic more powerful than he understands. If allowed to rage unchecked, the plague could eventually sweep into the old world, too."
Small consolation. Did the spirit say how Jagang stole this magic from the Temple of the Winds? Colin nodded as she looked away from his eyes.
"You were right about the red moons. It was a warning that the Temple of the Winds had been violated."
Colin told him about the Hall of the Betrayer and how Sister Amelia had been able to tread that path. Colin recounted the rest of her meeting with the spirit of Chandalin's grandfather, as best as she could remember it, including the part about the temple being at least partially sentient, as Richard had suspected. Richard leaned an arm against the mantel as he stared into the fire. He pinched his lower lip as he listened patiently. Colin told him how the spirit had told her that to stop the plague, they must get into the Temple of the Winds, how it existed in both worlds at the same time, and how both the good and the evil spirits were involved and had a say in this. "And the ancestor's spirit could give you no indication how we were to get to the Temple of the Winds?"
"No," Colin said. "In fact, he wasn't interested in that part of it. He said that the temple would reveal what must be done. Shota said the same thing."
Engrossed in thought, Richard nodded while he considered her words. Colin twisted her fingers together while she waited. "What about Shota?" he asked at last. "What happened with her?"
Colin hesitated. She knew she had to tell him at least some of it, but she was reluctant to tell him all of what Shota had said. "Richard, I don't believe Shota was trying to cause trouble."
He looked back over his shoulder. "She sends Nadine to marry me, and you don't think that kind of interference trouble?"
Colin cleared her throat into her fist. "Shota didn't send Nadine, exactly."
Richard's hawk-like gaze continued to fix on her, so she went on. "The message about the winds hunting you was not her idea. The Temple of the Winds was sending you a message through her, just as it was sending you a message through that boy who died. Shota wasn't trying to harm us." Richard's brow lowered. "What else did the witch woman tell you?"
Colin interlocked her fingers behind her back. She looked away from his penetrating glare. "Richard, I went there to put an end to Shota's interference. I was prepared to kill her if she threatened you or tried to harm me. I thought the worst of her, I did. I was convinced she was trying to harm us. I talked with her. Really talked. Shota isn't as malicious as I thought. She admitted she doesn't want us to have a child, but this isn't about trying to keep us apart. She has a talent for seeing the future, and she is only telling us what she sees to try to help you. She's just the messenger in this. She's not directing these events. She said the same thing as the ancestor spirit, that the plague was started by magic and not of its own accord."
With three strides, Richard closed the distance between them. He seized her by the upper arm. "She sent Nadine to marry me. She sent Nadine to keep us apart. She's trying to put a wedge between us, and you are taken in by her tricks?"
Colin backed away from him. "No, Richard. You have it wrong, as did I. The spirit sent you a bride. Shota was only able to influence who it would be. She used that influence so that the bride sent would be Nadine. Shota says she sees that you will marry this bride sent by the spirits, and so she wanted it to be someone you knew. She was only trying to ease your pain in this."
"And you believe her? Have you lost your mind?"
"Richard, you're hurting my arm."
He released her. "Sorry," he muttered, as he withdrew to the hearth. Colin could see the muscles in his jaw flexing as he ground his teeth. "You said she told you the same as the ancestor spirit. Do you remember her words?"
Colin tried frantically to separate what she knew she had to tell him from what she didn't want him to know. She realized how unwise it was to try to hide information from Richard, but she reasoned that if she had to, she could always tell him everything. If she could get away with withholding some of it, though. "Shota said, we have not heard the last message from the winds. She said we will receive one more, involving the moon."
"Involving the moon? How?"
"I don't know. Just like the spirit, the how didn't seem to be important to her. What she did say was that this message from the moon will be the consequential communion, as she called it. She said we must not ignore or dismiss it."
"Did she know? And did she say why, exactly?"
"She said our future, and the future of all those innocent people, will hinge on this event. She said it would be our only chance to carry out our duty to save the innocent lives of all those who depend upon us to do what they cannot."
Richard turned to her. It was like death itself rounding on her. His eyes had that look, like Drefin's, like Darken Rawl's. "She told you something else that you're holding back. What is it?" he growled.
It wasn't Richard speaking. It was the Seeker. She knew in that instant why a Seeker was so feared. He was a law unto himself. Those gray eyes were looking right into her. "Richard," she whispered, "please, Leave it at that.
His glare cut to her soul.
What did she tell you?
Collins swallowed as she panted with dread. She could feel hot tears coursing down her face.
Shota saw the future.
Collins heard herself speaking, even though she had intended to remain silent.
She saw that you will wed another. She used her influence to make it someone you knew.
Under his glare, she found remaining silent impossible.
She could not influence who I am to wed. I will be married too. It will not be you who becomes my husband.
Richard stood frozen for a moment, a boiling thunderhead gathering. He yanked the baldric off over his head and tossed it and the scabbard holding the sword on a chair.
Richard, what are you doing?
And then he was moving. He went for the door. Colin put herself in front of him. It was like stepping in front of an enraged mountain.
Richard, what are you going to do?
He grasped her by the waist, picked her up and set her aside as if she were no more than a child in his way.
I'm going to kill her.
Colin threw her arms around his waist from behind, trying to drag him to a halt. It slowed him no more than if she had been a gnat. He was leaving his sword because he couldn't travel in the slip with the magic of the Sword of Truth.
Richard! Richard, please stop! If you love me, stop!
He halted and turned his wrathful glare on her. His voice came like a crack of thunder.
What?
Richard, do you think I'm stupid?
Of course not.
Then do you believe I want to marry someone else?
No.
Richard, you have to listen to me. Shota said she saw the future. She isn't making the future, she just saw it. She told me these things so that what she saw might help us.
I've had all of the help from Shota I intend to have. I'll have no more of it. She has taken one liberty too many. It will be her last.
Richard, we have to figure out what to do. We have to do what we can to stop this plague. You saw those sick, dying children? The spirit of Chandelin's grandfather showed me countless other dead children. Dead people of all sorts. That will be the future if you do this. Do you want those children and their parents to die because you refused to use your head?
His fist was gripping some sort of ornament on an elaborate necklace. She realized she had never seen it before. Even though he wasn't wearing his sword, its magic drove him. He was a cauldron of lethal rage. Death was dancing in his eyes.
I don't care what Shota says. I'll not marry Nadine. Nor will I stand by while you...
I know, she whispered. Richard, I know how you feel. How do you think this makes me feel? But use your head. This is not the way to change what Shota says. You always said before that the future is not yet decided, and that we couldn't act on what Shota says. You always said that we couldn't allow ourselves to put our faith in what she says and let it direct our actions.
His eyes shone with deadly wrath.
You believe her.
Colin took a calming breath, trying to regain her composure.
I believe she saw the future. Richard, don't you remember how she also said that I would touch you with my power? Look at how that turned out. She was right, but it wasn't the calamitous event I feared. It was what brought us together and allowed us to have our love.
How can your marrying someone else turn out good?
Colin abruptly realized what this was really about. He was jealous. She had never seen him this jealous before, but that's what it was, a jealous rage.
I would be lying if I told you I knew.
Colin gripped his broad shoulders.
Richard, I love you, and that's the truth. I could never love anyone else. You believe me, don't you? I trust in your love for me, and I know that you don't love Nadine. Don't you believe in me? Don't you trust me?
He visibly cooled.
Of course I do. I do trust you.
Frustration replaced the rage in his eyes. He released the amulet in his fist.
But nothing. We love each other, and that's all there is to it. Whatever happens, we have to believe in each other. If we don't believe in each other, then we are lost in this.
At last, he pulled her into his arms. She knew his anguish. She felt it too. Hers, though, was worse, because she didn't believe there was a way out of Shota's prediction. Colin lifted the strange amulet at his neck. In the center, surrounded by a complex of gold and silver lines,
was a teardrop-shaped ruby as big as her thumbnail.
"Richard, what is this? Where did you get it?"
He lifted the gold and silver object from her fingers to peer down at it. "It's a symbol, like the others I wear. I found it in the keep."
"In the first wizard's enclave?"
"Yes. It was part of this outfit, but unlike the rest of it, this was left in the first wizard's enclave. The man who wore it was the first wizard in Kolo's time. His name was Barakas."
"Kara told me that you found the record of the trial. What did it look like in there?"
Richard stared off. "It was beautiful. I didn't want to leave."
"Have you found out anything from the book yet?"
"No. It's in High Dahiran. Verdeen is working on Kolo's journal. I'll work on this one. I've only had an hour or so to start translating it. I haven't really done much yet. I was too worried about you to be able to think about anything else."
Colin touched the amulet hanging around his neck. "Do you know what this symbol represents?"
"Yes. The ruby is meant to represent a drop of blood. It is the symbolic representation of the way of the primary edict."
"The primary edict?"
His voice turned distant, as if speaking to himself more than to her. "It means only one thing, and everything. Cut. Once committed to fight, cut. Everything else is secondary. Cut. That is your duty, your purpose, your hunger. There is no rule more important, no commitment that overrides that one. Cut." His words chilled her to the bone as he went on. "The lines are a portrayal of the dance. Cut from the void, not from bewilderment. Cut the enemy as quickly and directly as possible. Cut with certainty, cut decisively, resolutely. Cut into his strength. Flow through the gaps in his guard. Cut him. Cut him down utterly. Don't allow him a breath. Crush him. Cut him without mercy to the depths of his spirit. It is the balance to life, death. It is the dance with death. It is the law a war wizard lives by, or he dies."
Chapter 49. Clarissa sat curled up in a chair, sewing the hem of a new dress Nathan had bought for her. He had wanted to let the seamstress do the work, but she had insisted on doing it herself, mostly to have something to do. Nathan had smiled and told her that if it would please her, then it was all right with him. She didn't know what she would do with all the dresses he kept buying for her. She had told him to stop, but he just kept doing it. Nathan returned from the door, having had a long discussion with a soldier named Bolliston about the movements of Jagang's expeditionary force. They were the men who had attacked her home of Renwald, Clarissa had learned. She tried not to listen to Nathan's talks with his soldier friends who showed up from time to time. She didn't like to think about the nightmare of Renwald. Nathan told her that he wanted to end the killing, so there would be no more Renwalds. He called it a waste of life. Clarissa touched Nathan's leg when he came close.
"Is there anything I can do to help?"
His blue eyes turned toward her, watching her for a long moment.
"No, not yet.
I must write a letter. I'm expecting someone soon. Don't go into the bedroom to answer the door when they come. Stay in here. I don't want them to get a look at you. You don't have magic, so they won't know you're in here."
Clarissa caught the tone of disquiet in his voice. "Do you think they will cause trouble? They won't try to hurt you, will they?"
A sly smile took his face.
"That would be the last mistake they ever made. I've laid so many traps around this place that the keeper himself wouldn't dare to try to take me here."
He winked at her as if to reassure her.
"Watch through the keyhole, if you wish. It may be good for you to remember the faces of these people. They're dangerous."
Her stomach churning with anxiety, Clarissa began embroidering little vines and leaves along the hem of the dress, because she thought they would be pretty, and to pass the time while Nathan wrote his letter. When he finished, he clasped his hands behind his back and paced. When the knock finally came, he looked toward the bedroom where stood the door to the hall. He turned to her and crossed his lips with a finger. Clarissa nodded. He shut the door to the sitting room as he went to answer the knock. She set aside her needlework and knelt at the door to peek through the keyhole. She had a good view of the hall door as Nathan pulled it open. Two attractive women, about Clarissa's age,
stood in the hall. Two young men waited behind them. The scowls on the women could have cut stone. Clarissa was astonished to see that each woman had a small gold ring through her lower lip, as did Clarissa.
"Well, well," one of the women said contemptuously, "if it isn't the prophet himself. We thought it was probably you, Nathan, messing about in things that aren't your business."
Nathan grinned as he bowed dramatically from the waist.
"Sister Jodell, Sister Wilhelmina, how nice to see you again. And that's Lord Rawl, even to you, Sister Jodell."
"Lord Rawl," Sister Jodell said in a flat, mocking voice. "So we've heard."
Nathan waggled his fingers in greeting to the two young men standing out in the hall behind the two women.
"Vincent, Pierce, how good to see you two boy wizards again. Still trying to master prophecy, are you? Come for some advice, maybe a lesson?"
"In a little over your head, aren't you, old man?" one of the young men asked.
Nathan's amusement vanished. He flicked his finger. The young man cried out and dropped to the floor.
"I told you, Pierce, it's Lord Rawl."
Nathan's voice turned as deadly as Clarissa had ever heard it.
"Don't test me again."
Sister Wilhelmina scowled back at Pierce, whispering a harsh admonishment as he staggered to his feet. Nathan held his arm out in invitation.
"Won't you ladies please come in? Bring your boys, too."
Clarissa didn't think they really looked like boys, as Nathan called them. She thought they looked to be in their late 20s at least. The four warily stepped inside and stood in a bunch, hands clasped before them, while Nathan shut the door.
"Pretty risky, Lord Rawl, to let the four of us get this close," Sister Jodell said. "I wouldn't think you would be this careless, now that you've somehow convinced some feeble-minded sister to take pity on you and remove your Radahan."
Nathan slapped his knee and howled with laughter. None of the other four so much as cracked a smile.
"Risky?"
he asked, as his fit of laughter died out.
"Why, what have I to fear from the likes of you four? And I'll have you know that I took off the Radahan by myself. I think it only fair to tell you that while you foolishly chose to view me as a crazy old man, I was studying things you can't even fathom. While all of you sisters..."
"Get to the point,"
Sister Jodell growled. Nathan held up a finger.
"The point is, my fine people, that I have no ill will toward you or your leader, but I can weave webs you couldn't even understand, much less defend against, should you wish me harm. For example, I'm sure you detect the simple shields I've placed here and there, but there is more, hidden beyond those things you sense. Should you..."
Sister Jodell lost her patience and cut him off again. "We didn't come here to listen to the babble of a doddering old man. Do you think us stupid? We detected the pathetic magic you have so proudly laced about this place, and I can tell you with confidence there's not a bit of it that one of us alone couldn't slice apart with ease while at the same time enjoying a bowl of soup." Vincent shoved the two sisters aside.
"I've heard just about enough from this dried-up old jackass. He always was full of himself. It's about time he learned just who he's dealing with."
Nathan made no move to defend himself as Vincent lifted his hands. Clarissa's eyes went wide in fright as the young man's fingers curled and his face twisted with hate. Clarissa covered her mouth in terror as light shot from Vincent's hands toward Nathan. A brief whine sang through the air. The light from the young man scattered. There was a thump that Clarissa could feel in the floor as light flared through the other room. When the sound and light cleared, Vincent was gone. On the floor, where he had stood, Clarissa could see a small pile of white ash. Nathan went to the wall and retrieved a broom leaned there, just behind a curtain. He opened the door and swept the ash out through the door into the hall.
"Thank you for coming, Vincent. Sorry you have to leave now. Let me show you out."
With a flourish, Nathan swept the last of the ash out into the hall, creating a small cloud as he did so. He shut the door and turned back to the gaping gazes of the three people left.
"Now, as I was saying, you will be making the last mistake of your lives if you underestimate me, or what it is you think me capable of. Your negligible intellects couldn't even understand it if I showed it to you."
Nathan's brow drew down in a way that frightened even Clarissa.
"Now, show proper respect and bow to the Lord Rawl."
Reluctantly, the three people bowed, each touching a knee to the floor.
"What is it you want?"
Sister Jodel asked after she had straightened. Her voice had lost some of its edge. "You can tell Jagang that I'm interested in peace."
"Peace?"
Sister Jodel fussed back some of her dark hair.
"What position are you in that you could make such an offer?"
Nathan lifted his chin.
"I am Lord Rawl. I will soon be master of Dahara. I will be in command of the New World. I believe it is a war with the New World in which Jagang is embroiled."
Sister Jodel's eyes narrowed.
"What do you mean, you are soon to be the master of Dahara?"
"Just tell Jagang that his daring plan is about to be successfully completed. He will soon have eliminated the present Lord Rawl. Jagang has made a mistake, though.
He forgot about me." But,
Sister Jodel sputtered,
"you aren't the Lord Rawl."
Nathan leaned toward them with a sly smile.
"If Jagang succeeds, which as a prophet I can foresee he will, then I will be the Lord Rawl. I am a Rawl, born with the gift. All Daharans will become bonded to me. As you know, that bond will prevent the Dreamwalker from using his talent to take the New World."
"Jagang has made a mistake." Nathan thunked Pierce on the head. "He's been using amateur prophets like this with this tadpole." Pierce turned red.
"I'm no amateur prophet."
Nathan regarded him with a look of contempt.
"Really? Then why didn't you warn Jagang that by using prophecy to eliminate Richard Rawl, it would get him nowhere but into a worse predicament? Because it would leave me to become the Lord Rawl, master of Dahara, and most of the major powers in the New World. Did you warn him about that result? While Richard may be determined, he knows next to nothing about magic, whereas I know a great deal about it. A very great deal."
Nathan towered over Pierce.
"Just ask Vincent. A real prophet would have realized the danger lurking behind my simple shields, waiting to be triggered if anyone attacked. Did you?"
Sister Wilhelmina put out an arm, forcing Pierce back, and just in time, it appeared to Clarissa, as Nathan looked to be about to make another pile of white dust.
"What is it you want, Lord Rawl?" she asked.
"Jagang can either listen to my terms, or he can have really big trouble on his hands. Trouble a lot worse than Richard Rawl."
"Terms?"
Sister Jodel drew the word out suspiciously.
"The present Lord Rawl is young and idealistic. He would never surrender to Jagang. I, on the other hand, am older and wiser. I know the foolishness of a war that would take the lives of countless people. And to what purpose? Just for the right to put a name to the one who is the leader? Richard is a young fool who doesn't know how to use his power. I am not a young fool. And, as you saw, I know how to use my gift. I'm willing to entertain the possibility of letting Jagang rule the New World as he wishes."
"And in return?"
Nathan casually flicked his hand.
"I simply want some of the spoils for myself. In return for my assistance, I will have the rule of Dahara, under his leadership, of course. I will be his man, running the affairs of Dahara. Other than Jagang, no one will outrank me. Quite fair, I think."
The young Pierce was still white as a sheet and trying to look invisible behind the two women. The two sisters, on the other hand, were looking suddenly a lot less unhappy. They wore small, interested smiles.
"How would Jagang know that you could be trusted?"
"Trusted? Does he think I'm as stupid as the young Lord Rawl leading the New World right now? I saw what was done to Renwald. If I didn't rule Dahara as Jagang wished, allowing him generous tribute, he might come in and try to crush us. Wars are expensive. I'd rather have the wealth for myself."
Sister Jodel smiled politely.
"And in the meantime, how do we know you really mean this?"
"So, it's assurance you want."
Nathan rubbed his chin as he stared up at the ceiling.
"There is a Daharan army of close to 100,000 men north of here. You'll never find them without my help until they descend on Jagang's expeditionary force. When Jagang finishes eliminating the present Lord Rawl, then this army's bond will transfer to me. They will be loyal to me. As soon as that happens,
I will surrender that army to his, giving him even more men at arms. The Harans have a long tradition of warring for plunder. They'll fit right in with Jigang's force.
Surrender an army, Sister Jodel said in a reflective tone.
You see, my kind sisters, Jigang is trying to use prophecy to win this war. In that he has made a mistake, he is using wizards who are not real prophets. I could provide the expert service of a real prophet. His alternative is to have a real prophet as his enemy and amateurs to aid him. The aid of amateurs is what got him into this predicament, don't you see? But a small, insignificant slice of the spoils, I can get him out of it. I'm sure you can understand that after all those years under the care of you fine sisters, I'd like to spend my few remaining years enjoying the pleasures of life. With my help, there will be no more resistance from the New World than that offered by Renwald. If Jigang should choose to be unreasonable, well, who knows? With a real prophet on the side of the New World, they might even win.
This is the end of this cassette. This book is continued on cassette number 8. You should adjust your balance control to the full left position and continue listening on part A of cassette number 8.